Good afternoon. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick at the Heritage Radio Network. This is At the Root of It. Thank you to our sponsor, Edwards, in Surrey, Virginia, specializing in smoked hams. For the Week in Wine recap, Brazil looks to increase wine quality, as recorded by Decanter magazine today. As Brazil increases its production in the vine area, the country is set to improve the quality of its wines with the launch of a new national technical network called the National Viticultural Science and Technology Network. It will be geared towards investments in enology, research, and modernization throughout the country, and is worth roughly 500,000 euros. In southern Brazil, the network will take in Rio Grande do Sul, Brazilian's southernmost state, Santa Catarina, which includes Planalto Catarinense, and Pernambuco in the northeast. Wine production in Brazil increased from 389 million liters in 2007 to 428 million liters in 2008. So there's certainly some investment going on in that country with respect to winemaking. They're looking to become one of the additional leading South American countries for wine production. Berry Brothers and Rudd is to launch an online trading platform, which will hopefully be launched by Christmas. Fine Wine Merchant, based in the UK, will have this service allow its customers to trade their reserves on the Berry Brothers site and set their own bid prices. They feel this is the wave of the future, and Simon Staples, the sales director, quote-unquote, said customers will accounts will be able to broker their own wine. BBR may buy back some of these cases, but it's likely to be a customer-customer basis, where BBR will charge clients a 10% brokering fee on every sale. And lastly, probably the largest news of the week, was that Chardonnay has now become an official variety in Rioja. A raft of grape varieties, including Chardonnay, have been given the rubber stamp in Rioja, amongst them Sauvignon Blanc, Verdejo, and Tempranillo Blanco, and Chardonnay. The Riojan government finally authorized a set of new varieties and is trying to make Viora more fruity and fresh with the blending of these different varieties, as it's what they feel consumers want. For tastings this week in New York, today we have the VS Annual Portfolio Tasting at the Marriott Marquis from 1 to 7 p.m. And on Tuesday, June 9th, Brandy Library Spirit School Introduction to Scotch from 7 to 9 p.m. will take place. This is open to the public at Brandy Library, North Nor Street, and the cost is $80 per person. Seminars will take place with different spirits, cognac, scotch, bourbon, Calvados, rum, amongst them. And on Wednesday, June 10th, Riesling & Co. will be tasting their 1 to 5 p.m. at Tribeca Rooftop. So top vintages from Germany, Alsace, and Austria will be on display. My guest this afternoon is Tom Gannon. Tom Gannon is a sommelier and wine director at Rothman Steakhouse on East 54th Street. We'll be speaking about the service industry today and new projects that Tom has underway and his blog that he also subscribes to and writes for called End Taste. And we'll be back with Tom right after this quick music interlude.
I take a drive in my car.
Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. We are casting today outside of Roberta's in Brooklyn, and my guest today is Tom Gannon. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Aaron.
How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing very well.
Good. Enjoying the sun out in the benches here, which I've dragged you out all the way to Bushwick from your lunch.
Yeah. Sunny Monday in Bushwick.
Could be worse things, yeah?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we like it out here. And the herbs from the garden are just starting to be cut for some of the dishes that they're making in the restaurant, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, overlooking the junkyard next door, and I could see why they want to take it back from the banged up Ferraris and BMWs when you could have fresh produce out here.
So, tell me, you are from Rothman's in Steakhouse in Midtown.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, I am. I've been the sommelier there. Started there in March 2002 and worked there. I took a brief interlude, I guess, a strange interlude, for about a year, and I worked as a wine manager for Atlantic Wine and Spirits between 05 and 06. And then the guy who had replaced me at Rothman's went to Le Bernardin, and they gave me a better deal to come back. And after having seen the other side of the wine industry selling for the corporate masters of Diageo and Moët Hennessy, mm-hmm. It was attractive to come back work again as a sommelier. I'm a little biased, but I do believe it's the best steakhouse in New York City.
I have not been. I am sorry to say, but it's on my list.
It's on your list. You'll be there soon. I know.
But you oversee the wine program. Is there any other sommeliers on the floor, or you do the wine
directing? No, it's just me.
It's just you. Yeah. Okay.
And we have about, right now, a little under 800 selections. We sort of go back and forth depending on what really rings my bell.
It's sizable.
Sizable. I mean, if we had more room, obviously, being Manhattan, you have limited amount of space to store wine correctly.
Sure.
So, you don't want to go beyond that where you're all of a sudden pushed beyond your limits and having wine in places that might not serve the wine, so...
When you're not there, how does the wine sales go about? Do you find that you're more of a Monday to Thursday crowd, and that's why you're there that time?
Actually, we're in the Midtown Financial District, so for the most part, our busy nights are in the middle of the week. Mm-hmm. So the way it works is I'm always there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. But, mm-hmm. I mean, those are the busiest nights. And on the weekends, I'm there every other Saturday. The servers are fairly knowledgeable, and the list itself is... classic steakhouse presentation. And by that I mean it's a big card for the most part, about say a foot and a half long by a foot wide, and everything is printed in the inside, and there's an insert there that pops out. So it's not like going to Danielle or Le Bernardin, or
you know, volumes.
We have where you have just a thick 87 page book. I mean, ours is just printed small and it's there for scanning. So it is in a way very user friendly, I think. And the servers are, for the most part, we don't have a lot of turnover. So they know, specific vintages here and there, they know the wines.
They know the wines, yeah.
Well enough, yeah.
And I imagine you taste them on them regularly as well, just for... Mm.
Yeah, I mean, not 82 Margaux or anything like that, but yeah, we do hold regular tastings, sure.
How would you describe the service in terms of the wine service program? Is it casual? Is it more formal?
I would say it's a good mix of both. Certainly, depending on the wine and on request, we decant.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of, and I wouldn't say all of them, but a number of the servers that I've trained to decant when I'm not there.
Right.
Who understand what it is and how to decant wine. But for the most part, I mean, it is a steakhouse. I mean, if you were to really, I guess, level it out in terms of how people think of service in New York, you would say it's two-star service.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's not overly formal, but that's the nature of steakhouses as well. I mean, people don't want...
Right, they don't need the fuss.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Do you think that in the grand scheme of things with respect to restaurants in New York, or in the country for that matter, service is becoming a little bit more casual based on the number of fine dining restaurants that seemingly are going out of vogue? Or
I think it's becoming more casual, but I don't think that's necessarily because fine dining restaurants are going out of vogue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just a function of that more restaurants are having serious wine programs And those restaurants, by their nature, are fairly casual, no matter what the level of food is.
Right.
You know, they're very, I mean, the only old French restaurant left in New York, really, is Le Grenier.
Let's hope it stays.
It will. It will, absolutely. No, they own the building, so yeah, I don't think they're going anywhere.
Perfect.
And
your neighbors, more
or
less.
Yeah, they're two blocks away. And okay. I've only eaten there once, but I adore it.
Mm-hmm, me too, once.
Yeah, once, exactly. Yeah. So it's a memorable experience.
Well, that makes sense that that's kind of the direction people seem to be going in with respect to their taste and the way they want to eat and make it more of a communal kind of experience where you're tasting a lot of different things and ordering different wines, and people's palates seem to have really kind of sharpened over the past 5 years, I'd say, in the States, particularly in New York, given its...
Yeah, I mean, I think they've sharpened. I think that also it's sort of funny, you know, to watch the trends as a mm-hmm. sommelier. As far as how the wine knowledge of the public develops, you know, I mean, everyone, I think, in some ways celebrated and lamented the sideways effect.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I had a woman one time come in and asked me, you know, she's at the table and she has the wine list open, and she asked me if I had seen the movie, and I said, well, yeah, I've seen the movie. And she said, well, it was a great movie. I loved it. I said, okay, that's wonderful. And then she asked me if we had any Pinot Noirs.
Uh-huh.
And she had been looking at the list, so I directed her to where the Pinot Noir quite clearly said Pinot Noir underneath it, which was the American Pinot Noir section. And she said, okay, great. Is that a type of Cabernet? And yeah, and I kind of like, no, actually, Pinot Noir is its own varietal. It's its own grape, and it differs from, you know. And I thought to myself, well, it's...
Regress.
Bizarre that, you know, yeah, somebody had watched this whole movie and come in and seen that. But at the same time, it's part of the job description is that, you know, you have to find a way to connect
sure.
with those customers as well. Because here they are, and they're looking at this incomprehensible, indecipherable thing in front of them, which mm-hmm. is your wine list. And so it's up to you now to guide them.
Sure. You know. Yeah.
And I think... A lot of people's apprehension of dealing with sommeliers is that, oh, well, they're going to think I'm stupid, or they're going to mock me, or you know, whatever. You know, the image is always of, you know, some older, skinny French man who will look down his nose at you for, you know, your horrible choice. And that's really not...
That's not...
Oh, it's really correct. Not really what the idea is.
No, yeah, of course. Agreed, yeah. I don't see that much, anyway.
No.
We're both too young to have that have been part of our lifestyles,
so, yeah.
I think. But you were mentioning before we got on the show today about just ordering and dealing with the climate and being in Midtown and being steak and kind of having that association with indulgence in some way when you come in, how that has dictated certain buying decisions for you. Can you talk a little bit about that overall?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, when people ask me, you know, about, oh, how are you doing in the economy and how's it, you know, and say, well, you know, like anybody else, we're not breaking records.
Mm-hmm.
But we're certainly doing very good business, actually. But we are not seeing and it's a level of extravagance, I guess, you know, whether you want to call it extravagance or just...
Or indulgence
yeah. or really what at for a long time and... is considered sort of the cap of a fine meal,
right.
You know, whether it was, you know, cognac or scotch or a bottle of port, whatever it would be. You see a tapering off with that. You know, we're not selling Ikem like we used to. We're not selling bottles of vintage port
mm-hmm.
like we used to.
Mm-hmm.
So there has been a leveling off in that. There's certainly been a leveling off in the average bottle cost in terms of where it used to be. The average cost used to be, say, $120, $130 a bottle, and now is probably closer to $100, $90. Mm-hmm. You know, so and that reflects now, and I think every wine buyer in New York is sort of taking that into their own habits, and that, you know, we're not taking on the cult Cabernets anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you have to bow to the market reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is totally off the subject, but just leading in from the week in wine recap and the announcement that Chardonnay and several other great varieties will now be permitted in Rioja. What's your initial reaction to that?
I'm not, You know, I'm not really that excited about it. My initial reaction is that I kind of think that that's unfortunate. I don't think that the Spanish government or the EU is looking long-term or looking at the reality of how that's going to impact the perception of Spanish wine, and especially, I mean, obviously white Rioja in general, but
yeah.
I mean, it's very easy to say that, you know, hey, we'll let Chardonnay and we'll let all, you know, whatever varietals, anybody grow anything. But Chardonnay is a wheat. Chardonnay will grow anywhere in the world. It will grow anywhere you plant it. And it can be planted in Montrachet, or it can be planted in, you know, to be quite honest with you, we could plant it right next to the Ferrari here in Bushwick, and we can make a wine. Now, whether that be a wine that's worthy of drinking or even cooking with is, you know, a matter of conjecture, I guess.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I think in the end, it sort of destroys or serves to destroy the uniqueness of appellations.
Yeah. Right, right.
You know, by just allowing these varietals to be planted anywhere.
Yeah, that was my initial reaction as well. Well, thanks for that. We're going to take a quick break and be right back. Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. This is Erin Fitzpatrick at The Root of It, and I'm here this afternoon with Tom Gannon, wine director and sommelier at Rothman's Steakhouse on East 54th Street. Additionally to Tom's role at Rothman's, he's also a playwright, which I hadn't mentioned before, and I wanted to introduce that topic considering so much of the restaurant world is like theater, and every night there's a new show, there's a new curtain being drawn for whatever is supposed to unfold that night. So given your experience with acting and plays and writing, how does that translate to a floor?
Well, you know, I mean, I remember when I was the head bartender at Fleur de Sel, which recently closed this year, unfortunately, back in 2001. And the chef, Cyril Renault, always made that point, you know, the curtain is going up, the curtain is going up. And he was right. And to your point, sure. I mean, it is that, you know, I mean, anybody can make a meal at home. Anybody can, you know, can open a bottle of wine at home, but they go out for a reason.
Right.
And I remember being at the bar, bartending, and it was just one of those nights. We were a young restaurant and we were fairly young staff, and it was a small space, and so it was just, and we had had a lot of media attention at the time, and we, you know, whatever, it had been one of those nights.
Okay.
And one of the other servers, her brother came in, and he was a cook at Danube, at Boulet's restaurant, Danube.
Sure.
And, you know, he came in and ordered a drink, and I made it for him, and he looked at me and said, "How was tonight?" And I said, "It was a weird night." And he looked at me, and he said very wisely and sagely, and I'll never forget this, he just said, "They're all weird nights." And I thought, you know, and to your point, I mean, I think that's very, it's applicable to both restaurants and theater. They are all weird nights, mm-hmm. because you never know this person's feeling sick, this, you know, this What's going on behind the scenes? You know, whatever's happening in the kitchen and whatever, you know, whatever sort of drama. And it's always hilarious, like, whoever's screaming at each other or stabbing each other in the kitchen, you walk out of the dining room and it's just, all of a sudden, you know, you have to just put on that mask and you're somebody else.
We all deal with those smoke and mirror scenarios on the floor.
Absolutely. But, you know, being as a playwright, too, it's the dialogue. And I think the, you know, the
verbal... Is it good fodder for your ideas?
Yeah, sure, sure. And I think, you know, especially working in New York, where you have so many different... you're dealing with... You worked with so many different people of ethnic backgrounds and linguistic backgrounds. Really, some of the phrasing and some of the ways that, that people's expressions come out can be... absolutely unforgettable.
And then in addition to that, I mean, your playwright ideas, are they more drama related? Are they more comic? Do any of these situations that you have on the restaurant side of things lead into some of those human relations?
I'm working on something that that deals with the restaurant situation.
Good, because it's not really been tapped. I've never seen a play.
It's been tapped in different ways. Yeah, I mean, I feel like...
Well, not specific. Yeah, I mean, you can lead into certain, you know, relations between characters and whatnot, but you don't have to necessarily have an entire play about the wine or the restaurant scope, but I haven't seen too many that have that as a backdrop.
Yeah, and I think there's probably a lot of them that have been proposed, and I don't think a lot of them have been well done, so, so to speak.
So in addition to that, when you're not writing about your own things and playwriting, you also contribute to a blog called In Taste. Is that correct?
I believe the site now is, and I should have checked this before, but I believe it's blog.entaste.com, which was initially, I have no idea how they got my name, but...
Really?
Maybe I should have asked, but... the whole idea was that they gathered 30 sommeliers, wine writers from all over the world, international, and for the most part, everyone just sort of writes on what they want to write about, and to varying degrees, I think, of success and skill level, which is fine. I mean, it's sort of an ongoing experiment, I guess, and that's kind of why I got involved in it. It was just a way because, as I told you before, I'm not very technologically advanced, so for me to set up my own blog would have been really too much to do.
So right. So
the fact that somebody is like, "Hey, write for this thing," and it's like, "Well, I should write for this thing. Why not?" And
set it up for you and give you an iPhone application that deals with food and wine pairings to help.
Right. I
promote
mean,
as well.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how well because I have nothing to do with the business side of it, so I don't know how well that's going for them.
Well, for our listeners, End Taste also offers an iPhone application, which facilitates the food and wine pairing scenario for
anybody. I don't mean to speak against them. I don't know myself. I can't claim any real knowledge of it.
Do you talk about current topics on the site? Are you more about...
No, you know what? What I do is if it's a tasting that really... something I think really, really interesting. I mean, and as you know, I mean, you live here and you go to a lot of... it's like every day... We have, I mean, I'll have people come in. I'll have, if I was willing to do it, I could schedule 8 wine tastings a day in my restaurant. In New York, it's truly the center of the wine world, simply by virtue of location, that we're so close to Europe and, you know, we're equidistant for the most part from Europe and Napa.
Right.
And so, so we are the center of the wine world in that way, luckily enough for those of us who work in the business here. So... anyhow, it's just any really, really outstanding wine dinner or...
something strikes you and you want to write about it.
Something strikes me that, like, you know, that stands out. And it has to stand out because we are lucky in that we drink a lot of great wine here.
Sure. So. Have there been any instances like with cork recently that you've had experiences with, given the different captures and glass captures and screw caps and, you know, cork mechanisms that people are using these days? Has there anything that you've...
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I think that there's not enough quality cork made in the world to support all of the bottles that all of the producers that want to use cork in their bottles. I had really, I think it was in 2003, it must have been 02 or 03 at the Plaza, before the Plaza got broken up into whatever it is now, with Wolf Blass himself, the man himself, was there. And it was about 20, 25 sommeliers, wine buyers in New York. And we were all in this big banquet room in the plaza. Mm-hmm. And there were 10 wines in front of us. And two of the wines were his 2001 Riesling. And he said, I want you all to taste this Riesling, both of these, and tell me and raise your hand which one you like better. And then to a person, everyone in the room raised their hand for number two.
Okay.
And he laughed. And he said that, well, you've all chosen the one with cork. And we went back and smelled it. And he said, I suspect the reason you did that is because this is what you like. This is what you've been brought up with terms of, you know, your own palates. But he said, consider this. Consider how different in 6 months the cork itself has changed the character of the wine. And I thought that was a great point, because rather than, you know, whether you want to argue that, you know, cork is a better closure than...
What was the first wine? Wine number one was using a screw cap
Riesling, which we had no way of knowing, obviously.
Right.
But he did tell us that one was screw cap and one was cork, but we had no way of knowing which was which.
Sure.
But the fact that the closure itself, whether it's screw cap, cork, anything, is supposed to be neutral. It's not supposed to affect the wine. But it was a really powerful lesson, I think, for everyone in the room. And it's always stuck with me that the cork itself did, it very, you know, quite obviously change the character of the wine.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
and so now
and
all of
his
sudden,
argument was that even 6 months from now it'll further
right yeah I mean his argument yeah absolutely
mm-hmm.
rather than change the wine, it may actually cause the wine to then become flawed,
right,
you know, depending on the quality of the cork.
Sure and to your point, there was also the conversation that so much wine is meant to be consumed young, and for the screw caps to exist on those bottles, it makes sense considering that they're not going to age in that with that cork. So thus there's less expense that you're paying, because cork is expensive. And we wouldn't, you know, age an 08 Sauvignon Blanc from Marbleau too much longer than you would consume it anyway.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
So maybe saving that cork and using it for certain instances, certain bottlings where it really makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cork producers were under a lot of pressure, too, to just pump it out to where it wasn't quality. And, I mean, you could see that, too, depending on the type of bottles you open. And, obviously, I open many, many bottles a day.
Yeah.
And, you know,
but I think that's part of the ceremony, too. Like, in a restaurant scenario, when you're having opening a bottle with cork, there's a much more, you know...
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah, yeah. That's a romantic thing.
Exactly,
it's a whole, you know,
yeah.
you want to hear, you know, and
yeah, you present the bottle with the screw cap and you're almost covering it with a napkin to...
Yeah, no, I mean, that would be an incredible period of mourning if and when I would never be able to put a corkscrew into a cork.
Right.
I wouldn't know what to do with myself. So...
Any new projects that you're working on, or are you going you're going away at the end of the week? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm actually going to be in Napa on Friday, and with a couple friends of mine, one of whom is a partner in Sherry Lehman, and another one who works for a wine company, and we'll be going to the Rutherford Grill, where Chris Carpenter, who's a winemaker at La Colla and Cardinal, bartends on Friday night, so we'll be, you know, we'll be checking that out, which should be a lot
of fun. Nice way to arrive.
Yeah, I think so. And then the Verite release party is for their 06 is on Saturday, so we'll be doing that, trying to keep some of our schedule open. I haven't been to Napa in 6 years.
Wow.
So, yeah,
I'd say that you, I mean, imagine at Rothman's, you have a bunch of California wines and Napa wines that...
I mean, it's very, the list is, we have a lot of California Cabernet, a lot of California wines, obviously, I mean, being an American steakhouse. But you sort of get into this thing where everybody comes to you because you're in New York. So in a way, in a way, it's great. But at the same time, you can develop tunnel vision, which I am completely guilty of, like, you know, New York centrism. And, you know, you need to get out sometimes. And
well, now that you've hit 30, you know, this is a new chapter.
I'm way past 30. Man. I'm like, yeah. But yeah, it's a new chapter, certainly.
Well, good. Hopefully we'll reconnect on your visit after you get back. And you can tell us about some of the wines from Napa that we have yet to go see.
I would be happy to, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining today. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you, Aaron. Thank you for bringing me out to Bushwick.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks to Edwards as well, who's sponsoring our show this afternoon. And join us here again next week for At the Root of It. Thanks.